So Bernard of Clairvaux, as I said, one of the main themes he talks about is the love of God. And one of these verses that speaks so clearly to the love of God is from 1 John chapter 4. 1 John is chock full all the way through of meditations on the love of God. But these are just a couple verses from there. We love God because He first loved us. If anyone says, "I love God," yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love God, whom he has not seen. The first part, the first verse there, verse 19, is probably familiar to most of us. We love because he first loved us. And that's really the message of the cross, that even before we knew we needed the love of God, God had already proclaimed his love for us in sending his son to die for us. And it's only because of that love that we are even able to love him in return. But then John adds the extra element of what I also noted from the other passage, which is that if you really love God, that's going to overflow into loving everything that God loves, which includes all the people around you, even the people who aren't really easy to love. If you want to get to the highest level of loving God, in Bernard's way of thinking, if you want to hit that top level, what that means is that you love not just God, but because of your love for God, you end up loving everything, every part of his creation that he loves. That's included in the love of God. The second verse I've chosen here is from Song of Solomon, sometimes called Song of Songs. This is the second verse after the introduction. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. If you know the book Song of Solomon, it's this dialogue between the beloved and the lover, and sometimes a chorus of friends jumps in there with a line or two. Nowadays, most biblical scholars interpret this as a beautiful poem about the love between a man and a woman, and they remark that the fact that this has a place in our Bible, and has always been seen as having a place, says something about romantic love and about the place of the family within God's plan. That this is something that he delights in. It's not separate from more spiritual matters. It's part of a spiritual life. Back in Bernard's day, though, Bernard was a monk, so he didn't spend a lot of time thinking about actual relationships between men and women. For him, it was allegorical. And this is the way that Song of Solomon has often been treated throughout the history of Christianity, that it is an allegory of Israel, or later on, the church and God, the beloved and the lover. And that's how Bernard treats this verse. He talks about it as the beloved being us, the Christian, and the whole Christian church in particular, longing for the love of God, the lover who has shown his love for us. And this verse, this opening verse of Song of Solomon, he actually spends three whole sermons on just the first half of this verse. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. If you think my sermons are long, you should listen to Bernard of Clairvaux. Three sermons on, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... 10 words. But he loved to delve into this idea of God loving us and we being the lovers and what that relationship looks like of the love of God. So those are some of the scriptural themes that we're going to keep in mind as we look at this guy. See his picture there? He's dressed in a white robe. The white robe is the distinctive robe of his order, the Cistercians. And I'll tell you more about who they were in just a minute. Let's look at that first note there. Bernard of Clairvaux was one of the leading lights of the High Middle Ages, a monastic reformer, preacher, and writer whose influence shaped the course of European history and who remains one of the most read Christian thinkers to this day. Let me set the stage a little bit for what the world was like when Bernard was around. Europe had just started to come out of what's often called the Dark Ages, although I should note that's sort of a pejorative term. The Dark Ages were dark in the sense that not a lot of people could read and write. They weren't literate. But humans are still humans, and there were tremendous people back then who did a lot of good, and there were people with incredible incredible mechanical and technological skill in the Dark Ages. You don't hear a lot about this, but I was just reading, this is kind of a tangent, I was just reading an article this week that scientists are trying to study the way that Dark Ages craftsmen did gold and silver gilding on top of objects, because they got it so fine and so thin that we actually, here in the 21st century, can't replicate the degree of work that they were doing back in the Dark Ages. In fact, we don't even know how they did it. They were so good at it. So we shouldn't look down our nose at those poor benighted people in the Dark Ages. They were pretty bright. But we come to the High Middle Ages around the 11th, 12th centuries, and this is a time of more stability, and it's a time of great change, because at the end of the 11th century, the Christian world in Europe starts sending crusades off to the Holy Land, armies of people sent over to Israel, Palestine, to drive out the Muslims, to try to reclaim those lands for Christianity. They had, up until that point, they had been within the Christian empire of Byzantium for a long time, until Muslim invaders took them away. The response of the Christian West was to send armies to try to take them back. And the first crusade was actually wildly successful. They marched straight in, they took over all of Palestine, they even took over Jerusalem itself, and set up Western Latin kingdoms all up and down Palestine. It was not a very pretty story, even though Christianity won. It was a fiercely bloody event. And the Christians actually didn't hold on to it very long. Within a few decades, the Muslims were back in force and reconquered big portions of Palestine. So as we'll see in Bernard's day, they're going to send off another wave, the Second Crusade, and Bernard has a big role to play in that. You also had a number of problems coming up. We've talked a lot in this series about monks and who they are and what they did and sort of the rule of life that they tried to live by. The problem that they had run into by Bernard's time was that they had become too institutionalized. They were too much an accepted part of the landscape, and so they'd lost that kind of radical edge. There weren't many monks anymore who wanted to do what old Benedict had said and wake up at 12 a.m. and wake up at 3 a.m. to say their prayers and to eat very little and to read the Bible a lot. Most of them like to become monks so that they could actually live a really good, luxurious lifestyle. The people from the villages would bring them the best foods they could possibly eat. They were well respected. They got to hang out with all their friends all the time. It had become kind of a corrupt institution. And Bernard and his friends are going to address that. So that's a couple of the things that were going on, and we'll talk about a few more dynamics as we get going. The second note there by his picture says, Bernard was extremely active for a medieval monk, entering public debates about monastic rules and the academic pursuit of theology. He was also a leading voice against several new heresies and in the culmination of the Second Crusade, in which he spoke out both as a recruiter and as an advocate of anti-Semitic violence, as well as being a supporter and mentor of several popes. Let me talk just for a second about the Second Crusade. The leaders of the Western Europe Christian Empire decided, well, hey, we've sort of lost momentum after that first crusade. We need to send over another army. And the way they did this was something that we probably wouldn't approve of nowadays. The Pope would grant sort of a blank pardon to every soldier who signed up to go. That means that if you decide to enlist, left your home to go fight in the Holy Land, you were guaranteed by the Pope that you wouldn't have to spend any time in purgatory, which is what a lot of medieval Christians were worried about. They were worried about not living a great life and getting stuck there for a long time. So, hey, you get a chance for a free pass? Sure, I'll join the army. Get into heaven that much quicker. Well, of course, this is a little underhanded, but most of these guys who signed up were really sincere believers. Around the 1140s, they decide they need to do another one of these, and so they send out preachers, and Bernard is one of those preachers to sort of get people going, to rouse their spirits, to get them excited about marching out to war for the cause of Christianity and all this. And Bernard does a really good job at that. He's a great preacher. But things get out of hand really quick, and it even gives Bernard some pause. One of the other preachers who was doing this recruiting started saying, "Let's go get those Muslims over in the Holy Land, and if you need a little practice, let's start right here by getting rid of the Jews that are living here in the Rhineland, in France, in Germany with us." There was a lot of prejudice against Jews back in the medieval world. And this was one of the darkest moments. And some of them started carrying out vicious massacres of Jews all the way up and down the Rhine and in other places in Europe. This was a very difficult time in England for the Jews as well. Bernard saw this, and contrary to the spirit of the times, he was one of the only ones who stood up and said, "Hold on, we can't be doing that. This is just butchery for no good reason. These Jews may not be Christians, but that does not mean that they deserve this kind of violence and persecution. They are loved by God, just as we are." So he did stand up for a very good cause in that instance. The final note there talks about his writings. Bernard's writings are centered on the personal experience of the love of God. His most famous works are the classic treatise on loving God and a series of sermons on the Song of Solomon. Most of the quotes, in fact, I think all the quotes that we'll look at later, are from his treatise on loving God. It's really a fantastic book. It's the only one of his works that I've read in completely, but it's not long and it's pretty easy to read and it's really, really good. So that's one I'd suggest to you if you're willing to delve into some medieval theology for a little bit. Let's look at his life here. In 1113, as a young man of 23 from a noble French family, Bernard decided to join the newly founded order of Cistercian monks. The Cistercians were a reform movement within monasticism, trying to bring its monks back in line with the ideals of the original founder, Benedict. Bernard joined the Abbey of Citeaux and managed to convince 30 others from among his friends and family to become monks along with him. So our already young Bernard is very charismatic, very persuasive. He decides he's going to become a monk, and not just any monk, he's going to be a Cistercian. The Cistercians were hardliners. They were reactionaries against that tendency that I just told you about, of monks becoming sort of lackadaisical, sitting back and enjoying life, not working hard, not praying hard as they were originally intended to do. The Cistercians said, "No, we're going back to the original rule that Benedict wrote, and we're going to do everything the hardest way possible." So they filled up their lives with all of these duties of praying, of reading the Bible, of having communal prayer 7 times a day on the hour. They had strict rules of silence, so for most of the day you weren't even allowed to talk. You just had to do your work, pray, even though you were right next to everyone else. You usually weren't allowed to say something. There's still some of these out there. If you've ever heard of Trappist monks, like Thomas Merton. Thomas Merton is a Trappist monk, wrote some very influential books of meditation, spirituality in the 20th century. They're an outgrowth from the Cistercians, and they follow the same rule of solitude and silence as spiritual disciplines. Doesn't sound like a great time, does it? I don't think I would want to be a Cistercian monk. But Bernard convinces 30 people from his friends and families to come along with him, including most of his brothers and a couple of his uncles. They all become Cistercian monks. 1115. Bernard was such an exemplary monk that after less than 3 years at Citeaux, he became the abbot and founder of a new abbey at Clairvaux. And that's where his name comes from, of course. During his career as abbot, he would become the leading voice of the Cistercian order and would personally found over 70 new monasteries and promote the founding of another 100. So he is extremely influential. In the world of their day, if If you knew of any one public figure, the top of that list would have been Bernard of Clairvaux. He was more well-known than the Pope. He was more well-known than most of the kings of Europe. He was just so popular and so good at what he did. In the 1120s, Bernard writes many of his most famous treatises, including The Steps of Humility and Pride and On Loving God. And I want us to flip to the back page for just a second, that added sheet on the back. These are from his treatise, The Steps of Pride and Steps of Humility. This is what I called the original 12-step program. And I think this is kind of insightful because he shows us the growth of spiritual diseases as kind of a slippery slope, as things to be careful of. And so he gives you the steps of pride, starting out at sort of the lowest forms, and then you get into more dangerous territory until you're sort of full-blown down there at number 12. And the opposites are the steps of humility. 12 is sort of the lowest form, but you start working up to number 1. And I want to walk through these really quickly. These are made for use in monasteries. So a lot of the things they say might strike us as kind of nitpicky. But when you're living in a monastery together, these sorts of details have a lot to do with the relationships and how you're perceived. And some of these are things we may never have thought about. So the first step of pride, curiosity about what is not one's proper concern. That doesn't seem like a huge deal to us. I mean, most of us do that. You know, frankly, watching the news could fall under that category. You're curious about what's going on in the world. Picking up a tabloid and reading it certainly falls under that category. Curious about what is not one's proper concern. The second one, light-mindedness, chatter and excitement, exclamation about things which do not matter. Again, that seems like kind of a light thing to us. But to Bernard, he's saying, look, these are just the beginning steps. And if monks are doing these things, that's a sign that they're not really engaging all of their minds and all of their hearts in this duty towards God that they have. Laughing about nothing, foolish merriment. That sounds kind of nice to us here in the 21st century. But Bernard's point is that if you have too much of that in your life, then you might lose some of the sense of seriousness that we as Christians need. I'm one who likes a little humor in my life. But if I was just telling jokes all the way through a sermon, you guys would start saying, something's wrong here. He's not taking any of this seriously. And the Christian life ought to be taken seriously. By number 4, we start to see, okay, this is developing into a problem. Boasting and talking too much. Trying to be different. Claiming special rights. It's worth noting that in our culture today, trying to be different is something that we approve of as a value. Be an individualist. Be different from everyone else. For monks, it was actually the opposite. You weren't supposed to be different. You should try to be the same as everyone else because that is an expression of humility. You're giving up your claim on what makes you special instead of grasping onto that and showing it to the whole world, which is what we encourage people to do now. And maybe that's a problem. Number 6, thinking oneself holier than others. Obviously, we're starting to get into dangerous, prideful territory. Interfering presumptuously with the affairs of others. Self-justification, defending one's sinful actions. At this point, we're almost at the point of no return. When someone is so prideful that they will, that when confronted with a sin, they will say, well, hold on here, I still think I'm right. Instead of saying, you're right and I was wrong. There's a problem there. Insincere confession. So basically, lying when you're supposed to be telling the truth about your own weakness. Rebelling against superiors, feeling free to sin, and habitual sinning is the worst and fullest form of pride. The antidotes, though, here's the good news. You can work your way up to true humility. Just takes a little practice. The initial step, Containment of one's interests, which shows itself in a humble bearing and lowered eyes. This is something which in our culture sort of sounds like low self-esteem. People who walk around like that. In a monastery, though, that was a sign of submission to your authorities, to your abbot. That was a sign of humility to those around you. You're not seeking to impose yourself on anyone else. Quiet and restrained speech, reluctance to laugh, keeping silent unless asked to speak. Again, these things are things that seem a little bit too far for us. But we have to remember that he's talking mostly to monks who were encouraged to keep a rule of silence as a spiritual discipline. And it's probably good advice for all of us to be a little more reluctant to speak rather than to throw out whatever comes into our head. Regarding oneself as having no special rights in the community, thinking oneself less holy than others. That's a big one, and that's a hard one. That's something that The Imitation of Christ, which is probably my all-time favorite book, spends a lot of time on. That you always give other people the benefit of the doubt. Even if there's a very good chance they might be miserable, backward sinners, you always give them the benefit of the doubt. You trust in the goodness that God has given to humanity, and you don't judge others. And one of the ways to do that is to remind yourself of how unholy you are. As far as you've gone in the Christian life, doesn't matter how far, you'll still have areas of your life where you'll be able to say, man, I really need to work on this. And those other people out there, maybe they've already passed that hurdle. Maybe they're further than I am in the spiritual life. Thinking oneself unworthy to take initiative. Again, that's something that especially would have been important for monks. Confessing one's sins. Patience in the face of accusation. That's a hard one, isn't it? When you're accused of doing wrong, especially maybe a wrong that you don't think you deserve to be accused of. And you want to defend yourself. Bernard reminds us that one of the great signs of truly triumphant humility is to be patient in that situation. To not jump too quickly to your own defense, but to show mercy, show humility to other people. Submission to superiors, desiring no freedom to exercise one's will. That has special application for the monastery. But that's hard for me too. That's one that I'm learning humility on right now because of my place in life. I'm the kind of guy who likes to have a little bit of time during the day that I know that I can use to do the things I want to do. Do a little bit of reading, a little bit of writing, something like that. With two little boys at home, a lot of your time is dictated for you. You're watching them. You're trying to keep them from dying in any manifold set of ways. You're trying to keep them safe. You don't have a lot of time. And sometimes it's hard. Sometimes I have to give up that desire for my own time, for my own thing that I want to do. And that's not hard. That's not easy to do. And the best form is constant watchfulness against sin. That's something that we have to work on our entire lives, really. Let's go back to the timeline here for a few more minutes. But I thought that list of the steps was interesting and convicting in several ways. 1127, Bernard writes on the duties and conduct of bishops, launching him into a debate about the appropriate behavior of clergy in an era when many bishops had become greedy landlords. It wasn't just the monks who had sort of gone astray. Priests and bishops were really enjoying the luxury of their positions and not taking it all that seriously. And this is going to actually go on until it sort of comes to full bloom in the Reformation. And Martin Luther and John Calvin and others stand up and say, this has got to stop. It's out of control. But Bernard was already saying those things 300 years earlier, 400 years earlier. 1128, a new semi-monastic order, the Knights Templar, is established with a mission of protecting pilgrims visiting the Holy Land. Bernard is intimately involved in the founding of this new order and becomes an outspoken proponent of its aims. I put this in here because it's an important part of his ministry, and because if you If you watch documentaries on the History Channel or anything like that, the Knights Templar come up all the time. If you read the Da Vinci Code or books like that, they pop up all over the place because they're sort of seen as this mysterious, shadowy, secretive organization that discovered some dangerous secret documents over in Israel back in the Crusades and have become sort of subversively anti-Christian in a dangerous way. Just so you guys know, there's almost no serious historical foundation for that kind of supposition. The Templars were accused of a lot of very weird and heinous stuff in the 200 years that they were around. But most of that stuff was probably all made up. The kings and the bishops of Europe began to grow envious of the Templars because they were fabulously wealthy. They had devised a system of banking in Europe at a time when there were no banks, and they had enormous wealth. And so the kings and the bishops, and this tells you the kind of era they were living in, looked at the Knights Templar and said, "We want that. We want what they have." And so they started grinding out this rumor mill of all these strange and weird and shadowy things about the Templars. Which, so far as serious historians are concerned, probably have not a lot of basis in fact. That's just FYI. 1130 to 1138. After Pope Honorius II dies, an 8-year schism ensues between rival new popes. Bernard weighs into this fight in support of Innocent II and is instrumental in securing his victory. And again, this is a marker of the times they lived in. Imagine if this happened now. I mean, none of us are Catholic, but we see enough of it on the news to know how it's supposed to work. Imagine if after Benedict stepped down, Francis was elected, but then someone else, some other cardinal steps forward and says, "No, hold on. I'm actually supposed to be the real pope." And he starts gathering bishops behind him and clergy people who will support his position. And you have Francis and this other guy fighting it out for 8 years. It's not a really good picture of the church, is it? Well, that happened back then, and Bernard stepped in and tried to solve the fight and really helped solve it. 1139, Bernard joins a debate against Abelard, who advocates a radical new approach to doing theology, making it the purview of academics rather than priests, and opening it to a new spirit of questioning. Bernard's side wins for the time being, and Abelard is condemned. This isn't really crucial for you to know, but it's a landmark in the intellectual history of Western Europe. Abelard is one of the voices that stands up for what happens all the time in our universities now, sort of the mood of scholarship that questions everything. Start from a position of doubt and then see what you can prove. That was very different from the way theology was done in the Middle Ages, where they start from a position of faith and explore the truth through rigorous thought. Anyway, Abelard didn't win back then, but it's sort of taken over the university system nowadays. 1145, after the death of Pope Innocent II, Bernard's former pupil becomes Pope Eugenius III. And Bernard was so popular and so widely known that Eugenius, who's now the Pope, writes to him and says, "Actually, Bernard, you're kind of the real Pope right now." So everyone in Europe knew this guy. And he was a mentor to this Pope and Innocent who had gone before. 1146 to 1147, I've already touched on this. Bernard preaches in favor of the Second Crusade. Doesn't last long because it ends in defeat in 1148. Second Crusade was the beginning of many tragic failures among the Crusades. They really should have stopped much sooner than they did. I want to spend our last few minutes with these quotes and this schematic that Bernard has thought up about the love of God, because this has been one of the things that I have been able to think about and apply to my spiritual life as a good challenge for where I am in growing. These are the four steps of love from his treatise on loving God. The first, the most basic step, loving oneself for one's own sake. Basically, everyone in the world does that. If you are a human being, you are naturally self-centered. You want to get the things that please you. You want to get the kind of food that pleases you. You want to do the sorts of entertainments that please you. You're focusing all your desires on yourself. Next step up, sort of the awakening of faith. Loving God for one's own sake. Serving Him because it makes us feel good, gets us to heaven. That's the explanation I put down there. So probably most early Christians start in this phase. It's not a bad place to start, but Bernard's pointing out that it's not the height that we can get to. A lot of people who become Christians because, well, I don't really want to go to hell, or because, gosh, I come in here to church and it makes me feel really good. I like feeling at peace. I like feeling warm and fuzzy inside, and it does that for me. So, I mean, that's okay. That's a good starting place, but that's not where we want to leave it. Number three, loving God for God's own sake. Seeing the majesty and goodness of God and loving Him simply because of the greatness of who He is. Here we start getting to the fullness of the Christian faith. This is really a great place to be in terms of your faith. And it connects with the first quote down here. I'm going to jump down to the quote before we go back up to verse 4. The main reason for loving God is God Himself. When someone asks, "Why should I love God?" he may mean, "What is lovely in God?" or "What shall I gain by loving God?" In either case, the same sufficient cause of love exists, namely, God Himself. That means, if someone's asking, "Well, what's lovely in God?" the answer is, everything. God is lovely. God is majestic and awesome and worthy of love. Or if someone asks, "What shall I gain by loving God?" the answer is the same. You're going to gain God Himself. You're going to be in relationship with the God of the universe. And so He is worthy of all of our love. The next quote there continues on sort of this. One of the ideas he develops in his treatise is about what God has done for us. And I love his way of putting this. In the first creation, that's the creation of the world, in the first creation, God gave me myself. But in His new creation, He gave me Himself. And by that gift restored to me the self that I had lost. Created first, and then restored, I owe Him myself twice over. Isn't that a neat way of putting it? That in the first creation we were given ourselves as human beings, but we blew it. We sort of lost our God-given identity through sin. In the new creation through Christ, God not only gives us that back, our original human identity as the image of God, He gives us Himself too. The third quote there is connects with this idea of the spiritual life and what we really need in opposition to that first level of love. It says, "Righteousness is the natural and essential food of the soul, by which can no more be satisfied by earthly treasures than the hunger of the body can be satisfied by air. If you should see a starving man standing with mouth open to the wind, inhaling drafts of air as if in hope of gratifying his hunger, you would think him a lunatic. But it is no less foolish to imagine that the soul can be satisfied with worldly things." Isn't that a great image? I love that. Just the foolishness of someone trying to gulp down as much air as he can get, thinking that that will soothe his hunger. It's the same way with us, same way with the world. They're trying to sate the hunger of their spiritual lives, but they can't do it with TV and money and all these other things they run after. Let's jump back up to the fourth and final step of the four steps of love. And really, if you and I had been devising this schema from the beginning, we might have stopped at verse 3. That sounds like what Christian love should be about. But Bernard takes us one step more. Loving oneself for God's sake. As we grow closer to God, we are so full of His love that we love all that He loves, including ourselves. If you've been a Christian long enough, even if you've been a human being, you know that it's awfully hard to love yourself. We are very tough on ourselves. Sometimes rightly so, but often too much so. When we think of the love that God has for us, we need to start to learn to see ourselves through God's eyes. that he sees us as worthy of love, that we are prized beyond anything in the universe, more than stars, more than galaxies. We are prized by God. And so when we love God to the fullest measure, we are going to love everything around us. We are going to love our neighbors. We are going to love the creation God has given us. We're even going to start to love ourselves in a way that we wouldn't have been able to before. I think that is a wonderful idea. One that I haven't really fully gotten my head around yet. But Bernard himself says he's not sure that anyone can actually fully reach this level within a human life. He describes that in the final quote on the page. "Here indeed is appeasement without weariness. Here never quenched thirst for knowledge without distress. Here eternal and infinite desire which knows no want. Here finally is that sober inebriation which comes not from drinking wine but from enjoying God. The fourth degree of love is attained forever when we love God only and supremely, when we do not even love ourselves except for God's sake, so that He Himself is the reward of them that love Him, the everlasting reward of an everlasting love." What wonderful words. You can see why this guy was so highly respected in his day. So I hope you'll take some of these ideas from Bernard and be encouraged in your growth as a Christian in loving God and understanding His love for you. In closing, I actually want to sing a chorus, and it's one that you all will know. It'll be a number 78 in your hymnals. And this is the great chorus, "I Love You, Lord."